Fighting continues across Ukraine's southern region.
We have reports from Mariupol that up to 40 missiles hit the city. 3 people were injured. 2 people are in the hospital for the moment. Among those hospitalized is a 12-year-old boy.
Plus, what's next after a UN Security Council meeting over the shelling around Europe's largest nuclear power plant?
Well, I think there was certainly unanimity from the 15 council members, including Russia, that this IAEA mission should go forward and as soon as possible.
And later in the program, how children in Chicago set a world record while raising money for those affected by the war. Today is Friday, August 12th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukraine and Russia accused each other on Friday of risking nuclear disaster by shelling the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is Europe's largest. It is also currently occupied by Russian forces in a region that some expect to become one of the next big front lines of the war. The plant dominates the southern bank of a vast reservoir along the Dnipro River that cuts across southern Ukraine. Ukrainian forces controlling the towns and cities on the opposite bank have come under intense bombardment from the Russian-held side. Joining us from Kyiv, Ukraine, is reporter Anna Chernikova. Anna, fighting continues throughout Ukraine, but where I want to begin today is, can you give us a brief update as to what's taking place between Russian and Ukrainian forces in the eastern Donbas region?
Very heavy fightings continue in Donbas area. According to the latest information from the General Staff of Ukraine, for the past day and over the night, Russian forces conducted offensive battles near a number of settlements in the Bakhmut and Avdiivka areas. But Russian forces were unsuccessful. Ukrainians managed to keep the front line unchanged, and Russian forces had to withdraw from that area. So the area of Bakhmut remains under Ukrainian control. And at the moment, fightings continues near Pisky. It's also a very difficult area for the moment for both Ukrainians and Russian forces. However, Russian forces had a partial success next to Horlivka, and also fightings continue there. What also was reported that Slovensk and Kramatorsk directions are under very heavy shellings, and particularly residential areas and mainly populated areas. This is what we have for the moment on Donbas.
Anna, what about the southern Dnipro region?
Dnipropetrovsk region was under a massive missile strike over the night and during the last day. We have reports from Mariupol that up to 40 missiles hit the city. 3 people were injured. 2 people are in the hospital for the moment. Among those hospitalized is a 12-year-old boy. 4 residential buildings were hit, as well as several private buildings. There are certain damages, but we are still waiting for additional details on that. Also, the shelling hit a local factory and some civil areas like stores and restaurants. And also Dnipropetrovsk region, a city of Nikopol, was hit 10 times. Similarly, private houses and cars mostly were damaged. However, no victims are reported yet. So we can say that at least 50 missile strikes were just in Dnipropetrovsk region over the past day.
And Anna, there is, of course, ongoing activity in the Zaporizhia region, but what about Kherson?
The situation in Kherson region remains more or less similar. At least we don't have any confirmed information from the Ukrainian officials on any advances or anything extraordinary happening there. So we just can say that heavy fightings continue along the front line. But probably this is the most important areas that we mentioned. Maybe also Kharkiv region, also we should not forget, it's very close to Donbas. And Kharkiv region, particularly Izum and Chuhuyev, are also under the missile strikes and the city of Kharkiv itself.
Going back to Zaporizhia, that of course is the location of the nuclear power plant that is at the center of a lot of discussion over the safety of not only the personnel there, but for the region and to a larger extent, Europe. Has there been any change during the last 24 hours?
No official changes which we can report. So we do not hear anything new.
And we'll have additional updates about the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in just a few minutes, recapping yesterday's United Nations Security Council meeting. As always, Anna Chernikova reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Russia has asserted that it was Ukrainian forces that fired upon a prison housing prisoners of war, resulted in more than 50 deaths. Ukraine said it was the Russians who were responsible for the deaths at the Olenivka facility and have called upon the International Committee of the Red Cross to conduct an on-site visit. Polygraph.info fact checks Moscow's claim.
On July 29th, an explosion tore through part of a Russian-controlled prison near Olenivka in Ukraine's Donetsk province. 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war died, 75 were wounded. Russia's defense ministry accused Ukraine of attacking its own. Quote, "Tonight, the Kyiv regime deliberately carried out a bloody provocation. A missile strike from an American HIMARS multiple launch rocket system was delivered against the pretrial detention center in the village of Olenivka. That is likely false. In fact, the evidence points to Russia." Ukraine's security service, SBU, said it appears the explosion originated inside the building housing the prisoners. The SBU cited the lack of damage nearby and intercepted phone calls suggesting explosives were planted. Politico cited two US officials who said there was no evidence of a HIMARS strike. Six experts consulted by the Washington Post reached the same conclusion. Interviews with aid workers were held at Olenivka and released claimed Ukrainian POWs, including from the Azov regiment, were beaten and tortured. Some 250 Azov soldiers surrendered in May from a besieged steel complex in Mariupol. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of a war crime. U.S. officials said Russia may be planting evidence at the site to frame the other side. As of August 7, Russia had not granted the Red Cross access to investigate.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website that's produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation as well as misinformation that's being distributed and shared globally. Addressing the United Nations Security Council via video link on Thursday, International Atomic Energy Director General Rafael Grossi said a preliminary assessment by his agency's experts concluded that there is no immediate threat to nuclear safety following the shelling around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. But that could change.
Recently, the situation at the nuclear facilities, and in particular at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, have been deteriorating rapidly.
Ukraine and Russia blame each other for the shelling around the site that began earlier this month. Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent and joins us now. Margaret, the International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Grossi was addressing the United Nations Security Council on Thursday via video link, and he made the statement that the situation was rapidly deteriorating. Now, the IAEA has not been able to get people there to physically inspect the site, but can you explain a little bit about how the Director General is making that assessment?
Well, they're in touch with the operators at the facility, the Ukrainian operators. They've had some information from them, and they do have some remote machines set up. But one of the things he pointed out was that since the latest shelling on Friday and Saturday, that they are not getting remote data transfer from the fresh and spent fuel storage facility part of the plant. So this is something that's concerning. And so they're worried, you know, that they're not getting a full picture, let's say, of what's happening at the facility. And don't forget, the staff who are there, the Ukrainian staff who are there, they've been working under really tough conditions for several months now. In fact, in the beginning, the Russians took over Zaporizhia around March 4th, and they've been occupying it since with their soldiers. And in the beginning, the operators there, the technicians, were like basically working at gunpoint. You know, it was super stressful. And so one of the reasons the IAEA director wants to go, and he wants to go personally as part of this mission, is to check on the safety of the plant staff.
Margaret, Thursday's meeting was called by the Russian representatives to the Security Council, and Russia and Ukraine have been trading accusations as to who is ultimately responsible for the shelling of the station. Did either envoy at the UNSC provide any additional information?
Well, it's kind of the same old, you know, he said, she said. The Russians are saying it's the Ukrainians who shelled, and they claim the motivation is to make a Russia look bad as part of this disinformation war that Russia feels it's being beaten up with by the Western world. And also, they're saying that the Kiev regime is just so, you know, crazy and maniacal that they would do this. And it kind of beggars belief, because if the Ukrainians hit what is Europe's largest nuclear power plant, it's on their territory and their people are going to get the sickest. But the Russians say, well, why would we hit it or shell it? You know, because we have soldiers there, our own soldiers there.
So in terms of next steps, was anything decided?
Well, I think there was certainly unanimity from the 15 council members, including Russia, that this IAEA mission should go forward and as soon as possible. But one of the things the Ukrainian ambassador pointed out is that they don't control about a 5-mile area near the plant at where they need to pass through. That's under Russian control. So, you know, it's the IAEA, and the IAEA pointed that out as well. Mr. Grossi said, you know, the plant itself is under Russian control and in Russian control territory. So they need kind of cooperation from both parties to get there. And so far that's been elusive. But hopefully now that there's a little more political pressure, international political pressure to do it, and the spotlight is sort of on them, hopefully that will happen. That said, you know, hours before this meeting happened in New York, there was more shelling around the plant. So it's very hard to say where this is going to go.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. Margaret, thank you.
Sure, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Like other countries in Europe, Britain is experiencing a labor shortage because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But for thousands of Ukrainians fleeing the war in their homeland, the deficiency provides crucial opportunities as they resettle in their new homes. Tommy Walker discusses this next.
Britain has issued more than 100,000 visas to people fleeing the conflict in Ukraine. Under the Homes for Ukraine plan, refugees can stay with a British family for at least 6 months, then live and work in Britain for up to 3 years. Margarita Aleknovich has resettled in Gosforth, a town near Newcastle upon Tyne, England.
It was really like a movie because we saw a lot of tanks and military vehicles going nearby, and lots of plants over our hands, and it was really terrifying.
Trying to put the memories of war behind her, Aleknovich, who was a fitness employee in Kiev, recently landed a job here in finance. She wishes to return to Ukraine one day, but news that Russian forces are continuing their advance means going back is too risky right now.
My hope is to see my country safe.
There is also hope for Tetiana Kapshim, a former accountant from Chernobyl who left Ukraine for Britain with her daughter.
I will be ready to get back when I will be sure that nothing good happens. For example, at my home, it's safety, it's calm, and my daughter will be in a safe place.
For now, her only choice is to find work in her new home.
I'm looking for a job. Basically, I'm ready to get back to Ukraine even tomorrow, but I realized I couldn't because it's still not safe.
Britain's labour shortage has left millions of vacancies in many industries, including healthcare, agriculture and construction. Companies are blaming Brexit for reducing the number of European Union workers in Britain, as well as the after effects of the pandemic. A British Chambers of Commerce survey says 75% of companies are having difficulties hiring. Rafe Baker-Cresswell, co-manager of Northumberland's Boodle Hall Hotel, is Capshim's host. He believes Ukrainian seeking work is helping offset the worker shortage.
I think it's a super good fit, and I think the self-interest part of it is critical. So, of course, we want to help people, and we're grateful that we are not suffering what they're suffering. But the fact that there is a massive shortage of labour, especially in Northumberland, but all over UK, plays to the Ukrainians' advantage, I think.
Fadir and Valeria Skripnik recently left Ukraine with their four children and now live in Leeds. Fadir now works in construction and say they plan to work in Britain for as long as possible.
We plan, for example, to have both good work, pay taxes, and after 3 years, while our visa works, we expect for some prolongation.
But for now, the Ukrainians who have resettled in Britain are looking to get on with their lives and have some form of normality back. The question is, when the war ends in Ukraine, will they decide to stay in Britain or will they want to go home to Ukraine? This is Tommy Walker reporting for Voice of America in Newcastle, England.
They say they are fighting not only for Ukraine, but also for equal rights. VOA has talked to several Ukrainian soldiers who are also members of the LGBTQ community. Anna Wrights narrates that story.
I am a military medic.
I'm a soldier, an unmanned aircraft operator.
Mortar platoon. I don't know if you can see, but there's a small mortar behind me.
Viktor Pilipenko, Anastasia Konfederat, and Alexander Zhugan serve in the Ukrainian military. All three are on the front lines in the east and south of Ukraine. Apart from fighting for their country, they are also members of the LGBTQ community. In 2018, as an openly gay veteran of a volunteer military unit, Pilipenko started an organization called Union of the LGBT Military Veterans and Volunteers to press for equal rights in the armed forces. Konfederat is a member of the organization, and like others, she wants Ukraine to legalize same-sex marriages.
I'm in a relationship now, and there is a child in this relationship, and I want this child to have all the privileges I have as a member of the military.
Prior to the war, Zhugan taught acting. On February 25th, together with his partner, he joined the territorial defense. He says the war made him realize that he and his partner don't have the same rights as straight couples.
The prospect of dying is very real, and it makes one think about what would happen to a partner. If you're killed on the front lines, your partner has no rights.
In May, a civilian, Anastasia Savienko, started a petition to legalize same-sex marriages. She quickly collected 25,000 signatures, enough for Ukraine's president to consider it. On August 2nd, Zelensky responded, saying that to legalize same-sex marriages, the country's constitution would have to be changed, something Ukraine can't do during a war. But he proposed an alternative, a civil partnership bill.
It creates a legal mechanism that avoids changing the constitution and the concept of marriage. Yet it allows same-sex couples to register their relationships in the state and legal spheres.
Supporters say it's a good first step, but not enough.
Marriage is marriage. A second-class distinction or second-class relationship defined by another name is not equal marriage. It can be legally important, particularly in a time of turmoil, and provide some peace of mind, but it is not equality.
The bill could draw opposition from Ukraine's Orthodox Church, but LGBTQ rights activists say attitudes are changing in the country. Polls have found the percentage of Ukrainians viewing LGBTQ groups in a negative light has dropped from 60% to 38% in the last 6 years. For Lesya Bakalets in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
Just outside the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, a local police dog has become famous for helping keep safe the people he loves. Anna Kostuchenko brings us that story.
This German Shepherd was born in early 2022 at K9 Center in Irpin near Kyiv. 2 months later, Russian troops began bombing the city.
The enemy attacked us from the air a lot. Some of the missiles were aimed at our dog training center.
One of Russia's missiles did hit the dog training center. Luckily, no staff members, dogs or people were injured, training center commander says. This young dog managed to save everyone. Some 15 seconds before the shelling, he started barking uncontrollably, alerting the K9 staff who decided to run for shelter. After this incident, the dog was named Bayraktar after Turkish-made attacking drone. Bayraktar's owners weren't sure whether it was a coincidence until it happened again and again. Now, when Bayraktar starts barking, everyone runs for cover.
As soon as he started behaving a certain way, we just knew shelling was about to start, and we ran to the bomb shelter.
In March, Russian tanks entered Irpin, but miraculously spared the dog training center.
On March 7th, we saw tanks over there. They were approaching, but suddenly stopped and turned around. Maybe because there were battalions of Ukrainians standing near us. During the Russian occupation, we were in the so-called gray area, always under fire.
The trainers decided to evacuate breeding dogs, the ones that could have valuable litter. Only the animals that showed psychological resistance to constant explosions remained in the center with their owners. Occasionally, the dog left the center to work. Looking for evidence of sabotage, the dogs searched suspicious vehicles for weapons and explosives. They also accompanied people fleeing Irpin.
We used dogs to inspect luggage for explosives. We also helped the elderly and people with kids to get out of the city. All bridges leading to Kyiv were blown up, and it was very difficult to leave Irpin.
In early April, after Irpin was liberated, the dog training center resumed its work. Bayraktar is now getting ready to become a special search dog.
He is very active and clever. We will train him to detect saboteurs and looters.
But it won't happen for a while. The training will require some special gear, which was destroyed in the bombings. Anna Kostuchenko for Voice of America News, Irpin, Ukraine.
And finally, using 5,000 boxes of cereal that was gifted by cereal maker Kellogg's, members of the Chicago Children United for Ukraine, or CCUK, created a Guinness World Record-breaking cereal box mosaic, with the proceeds going to help nonprofit Razom for Ukraine. Michael Kotcher, one of the participants, spoke with Reuters News.
We wanted to raise awareness for Ukraine, so we decided to go break a record with a good cause behind it. You're looking at the Ukrainian flag made out of approximately 5,000 cereal boxes, and the previous record was 4,000, so we broke it by a big amount.
The participants used yellow Corn Pops boxes and blue Rice Krispies boxes to create a massive Ukrainian flag on the floor of the Wintrust Financial Corporation's Grand Banking Hall in downtown Chicago. Writer Schiffman, another member of the record-setting team, explains.
The Corn Pops represent the fields for the bottom of the flag, and the Rice Krispies represent the sky for the Ukraine flag. We came up with this idea because originally Michael and I, every time we came down or stuff like that, we always ate cereal, and we love cereal so much. So we decided, and we were like, oh, let's like use cereal as the perfect food to create the mosaic, the cereal box mosaic. And when we decided that, we were like, oh, what are we gonna do with the cereal boxes when we're done with it? And we're like, oh, we should donate it to like a charity or something like that. So we decided to donate it to the Greater Chicago Food Depository.
And so far, 70 donors have given just under $15,000 to CCUK's Cereal Mosaic fundraiser to help Ukraine. Well, that's going to do it for us this week. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.